Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, a quick word from Squarespace. If you are thinking about making your next move, maybe you're going to start a business, change careers, launch a creative project that's just been burning inside of you, Squarespace is the place to do it. They've got award-winning templates, and creating your website is simple, intuitive, easy, and you don't need to know a lick of code. To start your free trial today, go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code LONGFORM to get 10% off your first purchase, plus a free domain. Thank you, Squarespace. Also, just before we start, I want to tell you about another podcast I've been working on. I'm not the host, just producing, and it is called Missing Richard Simmons. It's about the fitness guru, Richard Simmons. You might know him from like Sweating to the Oldies. Here's the thing about Richard Simmons. He hasn't been seen publicly in 3 years. On February 15th, 2014, he did not show up to teach his class in Beverly Hills, and he has not shown up anywhere since. The show is hosted by Dan Taberski, and it's Dan's search to try and figure out what happened. I think you might like it. Go to missingrichardsimmons.com to learn more or subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And here it is, the Long Form Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm joined by one of my co-hosts, Max Linsky from Long Form.
That was a very pleasant and formal hello.
Thank you, Max. It's like you think that I don't prepare for these introductions, but here I am changing it up.
You have been classing up the joint for years, but that just took it to a new level. Aaron is not with us. He's doing magical things in California. You were doing magical things in Minnesota.
I was in Minnesota. I was there doing some reporting, and Anna Marie Cox, longtime political reporter, commentator, writer, lives in Minneapolis these days. So I took the gear out there and managed to catch her at her apartment. And it was great to talk to her.
I think we could describe her career as insane. I think her CV counts as insane. Can you tick through it?
It's sort of like a catalog of modern political media. Like now she works for MTV, who she writes columns for. She does the interviews at the front of the book for the New York Times Magazine, but you could name a publication she's probably written for it, from GQ to The Guardian. Also was the original Wonkette under the Gawker media umbrella, was the person who made that what it was, which was very prominent at the time. And even if you go back to, she worked at Suck.com and was the editor of that and a prolific writer for Suck.com. So she has really actually seen it all.
It's totally fascinating. I am looking forward to this one. Aaron, if he were here, would have some hilarious, witty way to say
he would
that MailChimp is sponsoring the show. I don't possess such things. I don't
just
have
go
that,
straight to it.
Get I don't have that it. Kind of flair. I'm just going to tell you 14 million people use MailChimp to send their email newsletters, and you should do the same.
We use it.
Atavist uses it. Longform uses it. Here's Evan with Anna Marie Cox.
Anna Marie Cox, welcome to the podcast.
It's good to be here in my own apartment.
Yes, this is a this is a full service podcast. We will come to your location in the Midwest if we want the interview badly enough. It's a lovely apartment. Also, this coffee is delicious. I feel like we could do a whole podcast where you describe the method by which you made this coffee, which involved Bluetooth.
In an app and Chemex. I take my coffee very, very seriously.
I wanted to start talking about a time and place where we sort of almost crossed paths, but I think didn't quite ever in person. Like we met a few years ago, a few years back, but back in the Bay Area in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember, we share a friendship with Bill Goggins, one of the best editors I've ever worked with, and
one of the
very,
best
very
humans.
Great friend and wonderful person. I think I knew about you a little bit because he was writing for Suck.com and you were writing for Suck.com.
I was editing. I was an editor.
You were editor at Suck.com. Yeah. And I just wanted to start at Suck.com partly because I feel like I'm not remotely the first person to observe this, but like much of what happens on the internet today, if you go back and read those Suck.com pieces, is reflected in something that was kind of like started in that.
I think the sensibility that we had has become kind of the personality of the internet.
Yeah.
Or a certain section of the internet.
Tell me a little bit about how you, where you were at that time and how you got into
that. I haven't told this story in so long. Wow. So I am a, you know, PhD program dropout.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to Berkeley for a PhD in American history and found I did not love reading a history about history very much. I was lucky enough to, like, I went to University of Chicago undergrad where we did primary sources for everything. And, like, I wanted to, like, just start writing. I wanted to, like, start doing stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather mm-hmm. than, like, earn my stripes working up the ranks and as a TA and whatnot. And journalism seemed like maybe a place that I could do that, right? Start doing cultural criticism, like, right away, not having to get, like, letters after my name. So I actually moved to New York, and I was in New York getting some culture writing gigs here and there. But my main job was I was an editorial assistant at Knopf, which is just dry as toast, deadly boring job. Anyone who's ever been an editorial assistant can attest, I think, especially like a big legacy imprint. You know, you carry around the jacket copy and I don't know, it's very reverent. And I found it not just boring, but I also had a lot of free times on my hands. So I was participating in all these like listservs. And one of the listservs I was participating in was called Chug Changa. And it was like nominally about indie rock. Like the Chug Changa is like the sound that like jangly guitars make. And like Steve Albini was on it and Gerard Cosloy from Matador and like other people that I could name from the mid 90s. And one of the rules was that you were supposed to keep things to music. And for some reason, like, I just thought that that was dumb. And I would just post stuff that was like started out about music and then like went somewhere else, like Kentucky Derby, I remember was one of the things I posted about. And it was like ritual that like the guy that ran the listserv would like send me a note saying, Anna, you're not supposed to do this. And that bad attitude and snarky behavior caught the attention of Joey Anuff, who was one of the guys that started Suck mm-hmm. when it was a secret offshoot of Wired.
Yeah.
And I remember I got an email from him and it was said, you know, I'm interested in talking to you about writing for Suck.com. And I was like, this sounds like a porn site. So, oh, because I actually had written like a couple of porn pieces.
About porn or for or
I'd written actually,
for
I'd
porn
actually
sites.
Written a couple of things like Desperate in grad school. Like I'd written a couple of like, but it was not, you know, it's not fun or interesting stuff to do. You realize if you're doing it more than once, like uh-huh. the first time you write a porn story, it's like, oh, this isn't. But then it's like, no, this is just dumb. And so I was talking to a friend of mine and I said, oh, I got this funny email, you know, to do more porn writing. And she was like, no, that's a real site. And she said, in fact, I think you'd like it. And so she called it up and I looked at it. And in fact, I did like it. It was rebelling against everything else on the net
yeah.
at that time.
Yeah.
Like the look of it was different. It was one essay a day and it ran as one straight column.
Like a skinny column.
Skinny column.
A skinny column in the middle.
Down the middle of the page. And their big hobby horse at the time was deflating tech utopianism.
Yeah. Which was running absolutely rampant. This is the midst of the dot-com boom.
Right. And so I made contact with Joey and then it was like two phone calls later, they're like, will you move here and be our editor? And I had not met either of them. We had not, like I had not written anything for them. Like the site barely existed, but moved out there.
This may just be that because I, you know, worked for Wired at that time. So maybe I was like more aware of it than most people, but it felt like the first place that people were like, you've got to go read it. It was a digital only thing that you open up in the morning or whatever. And like, you've got to go read what they're doing. But also that it was like, I mean, it was takes on the news.
Yeah, it was
and
takes.
Takes that started in one place and ended in an entirely different other place.
Very loyal defender of the take. Because, you know, there are dumb takes.
Yes.
And we have this whole vocabulary of takes now that's pretty like derogatory, but you know, the idea was presenting a framework that no one else has thought of,
uh-huh.
right? And that's what we tried to do.
Yeah.
And that's what, I mean, honestly, that's like still what I try to do. I mean, what we were doing was reacting. A lot of it was reacting to very current Silicon Valley news. And a lot of it was kind of just pouring cold water on it, you know? But also we expanded to other stuff, you know, like one of my favorite pieces I've ever written, honestly, was about Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I read that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which wound up talking about juvenile criminal justice.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like that's actually probably a good example of like the way these things kind of happened and how I became, by the way. I had been a pop culture writer and music writer for most of my career up until Suck.
Uh-huh.
And it was at Suck that all that stuff got much more kind of pointedly about politics.
So how did you end up in DC, like fully covering politics from there?
So the economics of the dot-com boom came for Suck. And
for many others.
And for many others. And it was just... they were looking for ways to monetize everything, and I just didn't want to. It just went against all my sensibilities and why I do what I do. So I quit in actually fairly dramatic fashion. And pretty much immediately, I got a phone call from somebody in Mother Jones, San Francisco office.
Yeah.
And they offered me a job. And it was actually as an editor. One of my jobs was to edit the pop culture section of Mother Jones, but it was also working at Mother Jones. So, you know, politics just sort of started to like the Venn diagram of my writing got to look more and more like a circle
mm-hmm.
with politics being like covering everything.
And one thing I'm interested in, because I don't write about politics generally, or I try to avoid it if I can. What do you think it is or was the what originally interested you about it?
I mean, when I say that, you know, like my writing, the Venn diagram started to look more and more like a circle. I mean, for me, I also, you know, went to college and went to graduate school at the height of cultural studies,
mm-hmm.
where people were kind of turned on to the idea of seeing almost everything through a political lens. Like, name a cultural product and you could find politics in it. Like I actually, when I was at the Daily with the Maroon, the University of Chicago, and editing the culture section there, art section there, we had a 90210 corner that was like a mock postmodern, you know, analysis of 90210 every week.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, so maybe younger readers don't remember this part of academics, but that was kind of a thing.
Actually, I remember from catching up on your old Suck articles that one particular line, which was about shooting Stanley Fish in a barrel.
Yes.
Which seemed very much of that time.
Yes. So, you know, a lot of my sensibilities about culture kind of formed in a atmosphere where I was looking at culture through this political lens. So it's always been a mix for me. And one of the ways that I continue to find politics compelling is that it's everywhere. Like,
mm-hmm.
and especially in this particular era, you can't unsee the politics in all of our lives and all of culture. You know, like we have an entertainer president.
Yeah, ultimately your Venn diagram became our country's Venn diagram. Venn diagram if you're writing.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't start it, but like, I mean, that is what happened. You know, those things are linked now very firmly. And again, maybe linked isn't the right word. I do think the Venn diagram that's a circle is a better kind of way of thinking about it. Because like it's, you see one through the lens of the other.
All right, I'm going to put Evan and Anna on hold for a second and tell you a little bit about some sponsors that are making today's show possible. First up, our old friends at Squarespace. And if you have decided to take on a new challenge, maybe you have a resolution of some kind, you're going to finally get that business off the ground or put that project up. I, myself, have been working on a podcast, told you about it earlier. It's called Missing Richard Simmons. We needed a website for Missing Richard Simmons, and we used Squarespace. It was so simple. It could not have been easier. Here's why. Squarespace has award-winning templates, and everything looks beautiful. It's a simple, intuitive process. You don't need to know any code. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse, and there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. So, go to squarespace.com. Start your free trial. Check it out. My guess is you're going to like it. When you do, enter the offer code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 10% off your first purchase and a free domain. That's LONGFORM, LONGFORM, for 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website. Also sponsoring the show this week, Blue Apron. And here's the thing you might not know about Blue Apron. They care. They care about where your ingredients come from, because not all ingredients are created equal. And with Blue Apron, for less than $10 per person per meal, you can get easy-to-follow recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients. And those ingredients are going to come from 150 local farms, ranches, and fisheries from across the United States. All of that is going to show up right to your door. The food is delicious, and it's from the right places. Here's some meals that are available in February, just to wet your whistle a little bit. Cashew chicken stir-fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. Udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. Or how about some roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad, and crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. Delicious. Check out this week's menu right now and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/longform. That's three free meals with free shipping at blueapron.com/longform. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now let's get back to Evan and Anna.
I want to talk a little bit about how Wonkette got started, or how you got started with that, because I feel like that's a second example of this sort of like center of the internet universe, like alternate center of the internet universe in a way. And so what were you doing when that came about?
Right. So job at Mother Jones, fast forward 6 years, something like that. I got married, moved to DC, and then, you know, it was not a boom time for journalism jobs. The web had not quite really exploded.
This is like 2004.
Yeah, okay. 2003, actually. 2003. Okay. And I was, you know, like doing freelancing, and, you know, I had a personal blog, which I updated, like, you know, not frequently, but it had a tiny little following in among people in New York. Mm-hmm. Corey Secha was a reader, and
he's a fine reader to have.
And he was working for Nick Denton. And so when Nick decided he wanted to do a, at the time conceived of as a, you know, Gawker for DC, Corey put my name up. And I don't know if there was like a, I had any competitors exactly, but it actually just felt like, here, do you want to do this? And actually, like, what a lot of people don't realize is the most important part of Wonkette was, for 3 months, I did it, you know, password protected, that only a handful of people like at Gawker could read it.
Oh,
because
it's
we
like
were just trying to figure out what the tone was, like what the like sensibility was. Because it turns out, like, I couldn't really replicate the Gawker insider knowingness, because I wasn't really an insider. Like, you know, my then husband worked at the Post, but worked in the books section.
You weren't like sourced up in DC and Congress and...
No, and I also, like, Nick wanted stuff like, you know, like who's sitting at the, where at the Palm? And I'm like, I was living in Arlington. I'm like, I'm not going to haul my ass to the Palm every day. Like, you know, so we couldn't really do like, I just didn't replicate. I didn't feel like I could exactly replicate what they were doing at Gawker, but we kind of settled on what I then came to call like the housewife after too many margaritas, like the politics of C-SPAN obsessed housewife after too many margaritas, which, you know, my alcoholism was not quite in full swing yet, so it was still just true and not tragic. So that was kind of the persona.
And how did you know when you'd found the right one?
It was trial and error.
Yeah.
Like, and I guess it just started to flow a little bit, and also like that kind of like wisecracking, but a little bit, I'm going to get in trouble for the kind of word I'm using. I want to say daffy, like not dumb or anything, but just kind of like, I don't care what I don't know. Like, I am really fascinated by all of this. I'm going to get some of it wrong. Like, a certain fangirl aspect to it, you know, because I am, what was true about that persona besides just the drinking was like, I think this is actually one of the ways the persona came up, which is I realized I was watching the White House press briefing and that I could recognize White House correspondents from their profile.
Uh-huh.
Like, because I watched a lot of C-SPAN,
uh-huh.
you know, and I watch a lot of Sunday shows. And so I knew who all these White House correspondents were, like in the same way that other people might know, I don't know, soap opera stars or sports figures. Like, that was sort of my constellation of like kind of famous people.
Mm-hmm.
And no small amount of Wonkette's success, though, was found in how desperate those people are for attention.
Yeah.
Like, so even fake fangirling, people are like, oh, yes, I've been recognized.
What was the space between you and the character that was, characters maybe not the right word.
Yeah, no, it's like the persona, like tone. I mean, I think that you would find if you got to know me in everyday life, like I am not nearly as vulgar or as abrasive, maybe, or like unthinking, you know? And then like, again, the Wonkette persona was kind of deliberately unthinking, like I'm going to offend some people and I don't care. I'm a human person, like in actual conversation with people, like I still, like I kind of don't want to hurt their feelings. I mean, maybe I'm a little more abrasive than your average bear. And that's one of the reasons why I think I'm good at interviewing people, actually, because I do have some piece inside me that's missing where I just ask a question without thinking how it sounds uh-huh. to that person. Which, sidebar, when I interviewed Joe Buck, the first question I asked him was, what does it feel like to have so many people hate you?
I just reading that interview. That came out last week?
Yeah.
Maybe? Yeah, I guess,
and
before the Super
like
Bowl.
My movie. Husband was like, who's so much more socially apt, right? Like, he's like a normal human being, more than normal human being about like social interaction. He's like very like gracious and charming. And he was like, I can't believe you asked that was the first question you asked him? I can't believe that. That's so rude. And I'm like, well, it was like, I know.
But also, was it just... Well, at least the way it was written in the final piece was not just a lot of people would say like some, it seems like some people out
no,
there
I was,
don't like you. What you said is every single person I asked said that they thought you were an asshole.
Which is just true. Like that's actually, you know, and that is actually how I said it, which is like every single person. And I actually told him the story that's not in the piece, which is that I was telling someone in a coffee shop, I'm about to interview Joe Buck, and a stranger sitting, you know, at the next table was like, oh, I hate that guy.
Here in Minneapolis, where people are so nice?
But also they have a thing against him because of like a grudge of some player that he, like whatever. But anyway.
So you've got that in your nature, but
right.
But when you started getting like pretty strong like condemnation, because it was also like wrapped up in this like blogging era where like
right.
real journalists were saying like
there
what
were
are these
so
bloggers
many,
out there not doing any
there
reporting.
There were lots of panels.
Yes.
There were lots
yes.
and lots of panels.
And very like stentorian complaints. But did you feel
bloggers
like
bloggers did the briefing?
The it truly did not bother you to sort of like put this stuff out there and then have people
maybe that's another like missing piece of ligament, you know, in my personality, in that I have this in common with Joe Buck, which is on the one hand, I do think of myself as a fairly sensitive person and I get my feelings hurt, sure, you know, but there's something that's weird when it's a lot of people, it's easier to be like, oh, well, you know, like when a lot of people are denouncing you, like it all kind of blends into one big denunciation. And especially also, I mean, this is actually maybe the most important thing, which is that I believed in what I was doing.
Yeah.
If I had any insecurity as a writer, and I'm sure this is something we all probably share, which is that I am the most anxious and the most sensitive to criticism when I know I fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I know I should have made that extra phone call, when I know I should have used a different word, when I went a little too far over a line. You know, like that is when other people's criticism will just take me down. Like 2005 inauguration, George Bush's second term, Wonkette existed in the motorcade to the White House. One of the Bush girls did the hook 'em horns figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from Texas and I know what that is, but I decided to play dumb and was like, made it like a joke about Black Sabbath and devil worship.
Uh-huh.
And I made a reference to drinking the blood of babies. And people were like, blood libel reference, how dare you? And I was like, oh, I shouldn't have said that.
It's just a tiptoe over the line.
Yeah. Just like one hair, like it would have been fine to go like hyperbole with just sort of generic violence,
mm-hmm.
but doing a making a reference that has specifically coded history, like, shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. No, I'm it's going to be hard to like go back to some straight like process questions, but I do want to ask you about the interviews you're doing for the New York Times magazine,
because
I love those interviews.
Yes.
And interviews in general, like I've went back and read older interviews that you've done when you were GQ and other places. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, besides being sort of like brutally honest, if you feel like you have a particular interviewing style or technique.
I actually listen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a cliche. You probably heard that from other people who do interviews, but it's amazing how few people realize that at least half of the job is just listening to the answer and letting that answer determine your next step. I also do think that I'm somewhat impatient, which can be helpful in that I, especially when I'm interviewing celebrities, this is a thing that I see happening, and I think that my personality is particularly suited to deal with it, which is that, you know, I do a lot of research for my interviews, and so when celebrities are on a junket, like, I'm familiar with the stories they've already told.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to be like, yes, thank you, but can we move on to the...
Like, yes, I know that one.
Yeah. I mean, to just say to them, yeah, I read the interview where you talked about that, so can we... you know, get to the next thing that uh-huh. maybe, you know, or I ask him a question about that anecdote, you know, that like made me think. Because like, I have found that even celebrities, people who are interviewed, you know, kind of as part of their job, are receptive and responsive to being heard. Like, they're bored with their own stories a lot of the time, right? Like, they're bored with the questions that they get. And I think to ask them something that like shows you've been listening, you know, like sometimes that's even for someone famous, like it's a little bit different, you know.
That someone was listening to them
yeah.
at all.
Yeah. That someone's like not just like, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. And also I think the other thing that I bring to interviews is that my overriding question for most people that I talk to, like that informs you most of what I'm asking, is how did you get to be who you are?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what made you the person that you are today? And that is something that I sometimes ask that exact question. And so even celebrities are like, wait, that's not a question they get all the time. You know? And
yeah.
yet everyone has a good answer to that question. It is impossible to not have a story as an answer to that question.
In addition to Wonkat being a sort of form that was developing at the time, you were also kind of like on the vanguard of like getting online abuse.
Yeah.
Like this was before like like people were on Twitter, and
right.
this was before Twitter and before like everyone was getting online abuse, or
right.
at least everyone
and,
of a certain type.
This is maybe a good time to talk about the ass fucking.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about that.
Because, you know, a lot of the abuse that women get online has to do with sexual degradation.
Yeah.
And I got that as much as anybody. And my solution was to just be like, okay, I'm a horny housewife. Like, fine. Make all the sex jokes you want, because that is exactly what this character, you know, likes.
Mm-hmm.
Or is like, doesn't bother her, you know? The ass fucking in particular... as far as like a reference, actually came about because already having become kind of a vulgar, like using a lot of foul language and making that kind of part of the persona. I don't know if you recall in 2004, there was the federal marriage amendment was up, you know, it was a, you know, gay baiting tactic that Karl Rove dreamed up. so that people who were against gay marriage would turn out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, if we're going to talk about this amendment, we might as well call it what it's really about, which is the federal no ass fucking amendment. I mean, like, let's be honest, like, that's what old white guys in the Senate are really freaked out about. So I just called it the federal no ass fucking amendment every time it came up. And for some reason, like, people thought turning that word back on to me would insult me, mm-hmm. or make me uncomfortable, or, and I just, you know, like,
but it became like weirdly associated with.
Yeah, the, I know. The and then, like, somehow. I mean, if you could do a word search, like, it wasn't like a thing that, like, I, like, personally, like, it's not actually a source of a lot of fascination to me. But people really, like, once you say that, like, for some reason, it becomes like, oh my God, you know? So there was that. And, like, also, there's the Washingtonian scandal.
Yeah, I remember that.
Where she had been she was a congressional aide who kept a blog, and one of the entries in the blog when she was still anonymous had to do with having anal sex and receiving a blender in return. So, and that was something that I still find hilarious and tragic. But in the persona of Wonkette, I was like, oh my God, like, genius, but still ask for, you know, a dishwasher at least.
Well, that... But also that I mean, if that felt like that was when the blog, like, went mainstream or something, like, it, or maybe it already was, but it took off in this crazy way.
Yeah, it took off in this crazy way because she chose to come out to me,
mm-hmm.
like, because I was, she thought of me as somebody sympathetic. I didn't go out and, like, beat the bushes to find her. Like, she came to me, uh-huh. and then, you know, I did an interview with her, and she had her own journey in life. But yeah, that caught a lot of people's attention. But it was a relatively, like, brief moment in, you know, the lifespan of Wonkette.
Yeah.
Maybe
it's just more memorable. Maybe that's why
it's it's memorable. You know, it brings a lot of, like, different things together. It was that, though, that like, I started getting booked on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it's the first time I ever appeared on cable news, and I learned a couple things right out the gate. One, have them turn the monitor off in the studio so you don't, like, your eyes don't drift to yourself. Because it's hard not to, if the monitors are on in a studio, it's really hard not to, like, watch your own image.
Yeah, and then you look really shifty if your eyes are not looking always directly into the camera.
Right, and then I had the good sense, and I think Corey actually might have been someone that counseled me on this, to resist becoming, like, the sex scandal expert. That's still something people will try to book me on cable to talk about.
Really?
Yeah. But I just nope.
And you resisted that by saying no to interviews, or by in the interview saying
no to interviews.
Yeah. Well, you wrote this thing. I actually couldn't, I don't know what the date is on it, for The Baffler, that I thought was really mm-hmm. fascinating about being on TV and, like, mm-hmm. why you go on TV for what they call hits.
Mm-hmm.
I think what interested me was the sort of frankness of it, which was like, this serves a purpose for me and the publications that I work for. It's also, like, a very weird experience. And you described the experience of makeup and
the car service.
The car service.
Yeah.
But also that there's something really, I can't remember the word, but, like, energizing about it. Like, that's,
if you're good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I think my frank analysis of, like, cable news hits, like, for me personally, is that I don't have any illusions that I am contributing very much to the national conversation. You know, I mean, I think people will disagree with this, but cable news has sort of gotten better than it used to be.
And in what period do you think it's gotten better?
I think the last few years have gotten better, in part because everyone's chosen a lane. You know, I think if you think back, like, even 8 years ago, it used to be much more two people yelling at each other. But most of the networks now have gotten into, like, well, CNN just has the Brady Bunch, right? So it's hard to have two people yelling at each other when you have eight people on a panel.
Yeah. But soon they're going to have, like, 20 people.
Like, buzz in.
Half of whom are, like, paid political consultants who just say, like, one line.
Right. So you don't have two people yelling at each other if you have eight people on set. And then, you know, Fox just has two people agreeing with each other, and MSNBC, to a certain degree, also has two people presenting, somewhat different perspectives of the same basic opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not incredibly useful, but it's better than yelling at each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, although it's also a reflection of how we're being siloed. So maybe it's not good for America, but it's like less upsetting to watch. Like,
yeah. Well, do you sometimes come out of those segments and say, that was really good? Like, I think if someone was watching that, they learned something.
Mm. Well, you know, I try not to go on if I don't have something to say, which seems like a really low bar, but I do think that there are people who do go on without having something to say because that's what they're paid to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky that I don't have to just turn up when they tell me to turn up. You know, I can say, yeah, I don't know, don't have anything to say about that subject, so please, you know, find someone else. And I do try to say things that maybe haven't been said before.
Mm-hmm.
And that has, you know, worked. And I try to be honest. You know, I'm thinking about, like, there was a couple different things that happened this past election cycle where I just decided to be absolutely honest, mm-hmm, about what I thought, which is not always what people do.
I think I know, or at least I can think of a couple of examples.
Yeah.
But it seemed like those moments, like there was a moment, I'll just offer my example. Mm-hmm. So there was a moment where you said, before the election was decided, obviously, where, mm-hmm, you said, like, if Hillary Clinton wins, it'll be black and brown people who will have saved us, mm-hmm, from Donald Trump. And that went like pretty viral. Mm-hmm. And then another one where you got emotional talking about Trump and
the sexual assaults. Yeah.
And it made me wonder, like, what are the incentives when you're sitting there in terms of, like, I mean, I would think it's like, it's a good thing when something goes viral.
Yeah, it is. And also, like, I don't care if I never get booked again, really. So I am okay with saying, you know, I think that Trump supporters are nostalgic for a time of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Make America Great Again is a specific appeal to a time when white supremacy was more entrenched. It's like saying they're nostalgic for a time when, you know, there were more union jobs. That's also true.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It was part and parcel of that era.
Yeah. But it's, to me, it's a not controversial thing, you know? It also controversial for a time when gender roles were more defined. I mean, these are not judgments on individual Trump voters. This is just, if you were making a reference to a time when America was great again, there are certain things about that era that are just true. You're nostalgic for a time before gay marriage, you know? You personally may be in favor of gay marriage, but clearly you don't have a problem with it not existing if you're right. If you're nostalgic for a time before it was legal. Ask a gay person, they'll feel differently, you know? Like, or most gay people would probably feel differently.
So your attitude going in is, I don't care if they book me on the show.
I mean, I don't want to embarrass myself, mm-hmm, but if I don't get booked because of something I said that's honest, like, that's okay, you know? And I think, and I haven't pushed things too far outside the bounds because I do continue to be booked as of this particular conversation. And the other thing I'd say about the sexual assault issue was that was a split second decision on my part because it was something that was genuinely happening. What happened was that it was a Lawrence O'Donnell show and he was reading from the account of the people writer.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to the part where she talked about what it was like in the aftermath to doubt herself. And did that really happen? And did I do anything? And, you know, that put me back. Like, my personal experience was having someone, you know, sexually assault me. The experience itself was not a particularly violent or abusive or traumatic, but the aftermath of what did I do? And is it me? And did I imagine that? That's the part that it cripples you a little bit. Like, and women have to deal with that just all the fucking time. So imagine if it happens over and over to you. Like, the way that chips away at your identity and your resolve and your belief in who you are, you know?
Yeah. Well, that sort of brings us back to like the value of being on TV, because that does feel like, in looking at the way that that spread, it's possible to have this like genuine connection moment, which I think I feel like happened again with Carrie Fisher, and you started this like Twitter hashtag around mental illness, and it also had this effect. And I wonder, like, do you feel that as strongly as you feel like the vitriol?
I think the positive connections, definitely I allow myself to feel more vibrantly than the negative ones, because those also feel real. Whereas when people are sending me hate mail or threats, one defense I have against that is like, you don't know me, you know? Like, I don't know. That wasn't something I always was able to say. Like, I think that's something that as I've become a stronger person, like, it's been easier for me to be like, the person that they're attacking, like, they don't, it's not me. Like, this is saying something about who they are and what they think. And it's not really, you know, like today, actually, just for example, like, I never make jokes about atheism on Twitter. Don't make jokes about atheism on Twitter. There is no one that is going to be happy. But like, I made the joke, atheism is the least violent religion, which is not really like a joke, but I made it just like kind of like, it's nonsensical and also kind of funny. And I know it was kind of trolling both sides.
Yeah. Makes you think.
Yeah, I thought so. You know, I thought it was, I meant it just kind of as a toss off, like whatever. Because people were like, I think the whole debate over what is the violent, you know, which religion is more violent is just a stupid debate to have. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to point out that it was a stupid debate to have, but like some conservative retweeted me and I started getting like, don't you know about, you know, Mao and Stalin, and a fair amount of it was, you atheist bitch, go back to your, you know, whatever. Like there was a lot of like, your atheist gods, or you worship at the altar of secular humanism. And like, I'm an out Christian.
I mean, that's one that like, just a second of research like, would have produced. Like,
I'm like super on my sleeve about the fact that I believe in God. In fact, I'm saved by Jesus Christ.
You're in fact one of the few, I think, let's say left-leaning politically writers who had a friendly profile in Breitbart, or it's like been written about in a friendly way in Breitbart.
Well, although it was sort of like you know, dog walks on two legs kind of thing. Like it was a little, oh my God, can you believe it? She's accepted Jesus Christ as her savior.
And imagine what she must be going through with her liberal friends. Right. It was a little element of that.
But
you've been very, you wrote about.
I've written about it. I've written about it a few times. Like I'm pretty open about it, you know, on Twitter. Like you know, my faith is very important to me. And when people have sincere questions, I am happy to answer them. But that's just the perfect example for like how I know this isn't about me. Like when people are writing that stuff, like they're writing to some imagined person, you know, not actually me. The other thing that happens with trollers, I learned this back like I probably like even like in high school, like working at the high school newspaper. No, it must have been college. It must have been college newspaper, where some journalism advisor said, the way that you really disarm angry letter writers is to write them back.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't expect an answer, and they're usually somewhat chagrined to discover that there is a real person on the other side. Now, the internet has changed that a little bit, but like one thing I like to do sometimes, like the other day, I said something I posted. This is now actually a pinned tweet on my profile page, which is that sometimes, you know, what's happening overwhelms me and I start to cry, which is just, or tears come or something like that. Again, some right winger retweeted that and I got this whole bunch of like snowflake, you know, kind of like making fun of me and like drink your tears kind of stuff. But for some reason, like someone with a verified account, that's actually why I chose to interact. Someone with a verified account was like, maybe you need medication. And I wrote back, I'm actually on, you know, Wellbutrin and Seroquel. What do you want? And he wrote back, said, I work, you know, like I work out at the gym and play hockey. And I said, oh, I have a lot of friends here in Minnesota who play in adult leagues. Do you play in a league or just pickup? And he wrote back, I play in a league. And I said, oh, how long have you been playing? Like, and then eventually, like someone wrote me and was like, you guys went from like snowflake, you know, mental illness shaming to talking about his hockey league really fast. And I'm like, yeah, you know, like it's just interesting to see, like, when you respond with like a genuinely like intimate piece of information to someone who's trying to mock you. Like, humans, even in this day and age, are like, oh, fuck, yeah, right? You're a person, you know? I've had it happen a few times.
We got off a little bit. I wanted to go back to the end of working for Wonkette because I'm interested in, we can't cover like every publication you've ever written for since then. Because it's pretty much a catalog of
any
place that writes about,
politics. Did that publication exist? I worked for it.
But post that era, did you feel like people wanted like Wonkette from you when you went places?
Yeah.
And how did you push back against that and not be that?
I was supposed to, like, you know, bottoming out and going to treatment for alcohol and drug abuse. Total like charm for that.
Was that it, really?
Yeah, you know, like, not really. I mean, I think, you know, I did manage to carve out a kind of like, she's the funny writer about politics, you know, politics, but with a wink. Like, I sort of had developed that beat in DC. By the time my drug and alcohol intake was overtaking my output of writing. But I think that bottoming out and going to treatment actually did provide me with this like real pivot point in my life, you know, not just in terms of like my recovery, but also I took 7 months off from the world. Like, I was in long-term treatment. I was in treatment for 4 months with no internet access and or very limited internet access. And then I lived in a sober house for 3 months after that, you know, with like other women, and like had a chore list and like had a curfew, which is a humbling experience for someone that, you know, has been to the White House and like, you know, done important things and talked to important people.
Been on TV.
Like, you know, my house mother didn't give a shit about that. Yeah. I broke curfew. Yeah. Right. And I also, you know, I kind of had to just disappear from career stuff. Like, you know, my editors were very gracious, but like, I just had to say goodbye. I mean, like, you know, I had to quit. Like, you can't, you know, and they, also my work had started to suffer. So, you know, it was for the best. And I had to come up with I had to make a decision as to whether or not I wanted to continue being a journalist. And it was an open question. Like, I really did consider going back to grad school. I considered, you know, getting a job at a coffee shop and working on a novel. I considered just other stuff. And then was offered a job at Guardian writing about politics for them. And I'm sure they came to me with the same kind of like, she's going to do the irreverent stuff kind of profile in their heads. But thank God that they also had like a wider imagination for me. So when I was like, you know, I kind of also want to write about policy, and I kind of want to maybe write some serious stuff, and like, these things are important to me. They were, you know.
And what, other than them offering that job, was that the thing that tipped you into saying, I want to come back? Or what, where did you land?
It's funny. Cause like, it was all happened kind of at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate, like, that their timing was like, as I was getting out of sober living, you know, if they had delayed their offer a month, like, you know, maybe I would see you across, you know, the bar at a coffee shop while you're here. It still is, I feel like I get nostalgia for having those choices. Like, I get a nostalgia about like, gosh, you know, I could be working in a bookstore. I could have decided to work in bookstores, you know. Oh, well. I mean, you hear this kind of stuff from people in recovery or people who've had some kind of big life change a lot, but like, all of this is gravy. You know, this is all awesome. I love my career. I love what I get, you know, I'm privileged to do, even in this terrible shit geyser environment. you know, I get paid to write, which you know as well as anyone, like, is a privilege.
Yes.
You know,
a lot of things have to go right in order for that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get paid to write about mostly what I want to write about. I get to, like, find out about cool stuff and interview cool people. And not to be overdramatic, but, you know, I could be dead. Like, things had gone slightly differently in my life, I wouldn't be enjoying any of this stuff. So if I was working in a bookstore or coffee shop or, I don't know, in seminary school.
That would also be great.
That would also be pretty cool.
Well, thank you for coming on this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Your sincere inquiries are also appreciated.
That's it for this week's Long Form Podcast. Thanks to Anna Marie Cox for hosting the podcast in her home and for making a quite delicious cup of coffee. Thanks also to Nathan Thornburg of Roads and Kingdoms, who suggested that I get in touch with Anna while I was in Minneapolis. Thank you to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thanks to our intern, Courtney Harrell, and to our sponsors, MailChimp, Squarespace, and Blue Apron. We will see you next week.